Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofano. As we head towards summer, the cases seem to be dwindling down, and we have one case set for oral argument this afternoon, and you are it. So, if I understand both sides are ready, so we'll call the case.
The court will now call Christopher Brown and Terry Brown versus NFI Recovery Systems Incorporated. May it please the court, this is Laura Green Bradford, will argue for the appellant. Robert Malone will argue for the appellant.
May it please the court. In this case, Terry and Christopher Brown, husband and wife, filed a lawsuit against Enterprise Recovery Systems for violating the TCPA, Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, 15 U.S.C. 1692, etc. The case was pending for more than a year, and prior to the day of trial, the Honorable Dixon Holman was appointed to sit and hear the case. Unfortunately,
when was he appointed, did you say?
He was appointed, I believe, 2 days prior to the actual trial date.
Okay. And was there any notice to the lawyers?
Pardon me, he was appointed sometime before that, I believe a week or so. There was no notice to the lawyers. So I tried the case. Unfortunately, I did not object initially. I didn't understand the proper procedure for doing so. Mm-hmm. I take responsibility for that. Obviously, it was something I'd like to have back, which I can't. Aside from that, I don't think that this decision and this appeal turns on that issue. Even assuming that there was no reversible error with the failure to step aside or recuse himself, I think that the Honorable Judge Holman erred in granting ERS's motion for directed verdict and denying the Browns' motion for directed verdict. And ultimately, solely on the evidence alone, I think that the Browns have established enough evidence to go to the jury. Telling in this case is the fact that Judge Evans had denied the motion for summary judgment filed by ERS earlier in the case, and the evidence presented to in response to the motion for summary judgment by the Browns was nearly identical to the evidence presented at trial. Now, the law of the case doctrine may not apply technically, but as a practical matter, it shows that one judge sitting in the same case found that there was enough evidence to warrant going to trial, and then at trial, when that same evidence was presented, another judge who was very recently appointed decided completely the opposite, that there was not sufficient evidence to send the case to the jury.
Was it the identical evidence?
It was nearly identical, and the elements in terms of the evidence that was presented on each element was nearly identical, and even if it wasn't nearly identical, I think just looking at the evidence presented in the case establishes that there was tribal issues on each claim. And I think all the evidence is contained, neatly outlined in the record, and I don't know whether it'd be appropriate to walk through, but I'd like to address a few of the legal arguments that were lodged by the appellee in this case. The primary argument is jurisdictional. There's an argument that under the voluntary payment rule, because the Browns tendered payment for the purpose of preventing or stopping accrual of post-judgment interest, that they somehow mooted their appeal. The argument that's made states that there was no express reservation of any right to appeal, which we know is false. Included in Our reply brief is a letter that I authored shortly after the appellees provided notice that they were going to send a release of judgment. Well, immediately a release of judgment, the consequences became quite obvious. And prior to the filing of the satisfaction of judgment, which is claimed to moot this case and this appeal, I sent the letter in the appendix stating in no uncertain terms the specific reason for the payment of the judgment, and I don't think that there can be any question of the Browns' intent to appeal. Again, it's important that that was filed before the
intent
satisfaction.
Intent to and will appeal?
Correct.
You think that's pretty definite?
I do. So I think the mootness issue is a good try at divesting the court of jurisdiction. I think because it can be considered, because it's a jurisdictional issue, although that letter's outside the record, was not before the court at the time of trial, obviously, it can be considered, and I think it is dispositive on the mootness issue.
And this is in the record?
No, it was filed in the reply. It was not part of the record. It was not before the court at the time of trial. But because it's a jurisdictional issue, the court may consider affidavits and evidence outside of the record for the limited purpose of determining whether the court has jurisdiction.
I think that the Texas Supreme Court has said so in Mijer versus Jensen, a 2002 case where almost an identical issue was raised. And it said it could consider information outside the record for that purpose, determining what the intent of the party was who paid the judgment to stop post-judgment interest from running. But I think it needs to be supported by an affidavit in order for us to consider it, unless the other side does not object. You do?
I believe that my affidavit is also included.
Okay.
Where's the affidavit? We just got these.
Yes, the appendix is very thin. It's basically two documents. One is the letter, the other is the supporting affidavit.
Okay.
The primary and the thrust of, I think, the dispute on appeal, at least, the briefing has been related to the TCPA and whether or not TCPA claims must be pleaded pursuant to a Texas statute. Our position, of course, is that there is no such requirement and that Texas Business and Commerce Code Section 305.053 provides an unconditional grant of, quote, that a person may bring an action in this state against a person who violates 47 U.S.C. Section 227, which is the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And Texas has allowed, through this enabling statute, a claim to be brought under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act in Texas state court, and there is no requirement to plead through the statute like there is, for example, with a DTPA tie-in. Interestingly, this case also involves the DTPA tie-in from the Texas Debt Collection Practices Act. And that statute specifically provides that a violation of the Texas Debt Collection Practices Act is a violation of the DTPA, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and is actionable under that chapter. The difference here is that the authorizing statute under relating to the TCPA provides that a person who receives a communication that violates 47 U.S.C. Section 227, which is the TCPA, a regulation adopted under that provision, or subchapter A, may bring an action in this state against the person who originates the communication. So again, there's no requirement to plead under or through the statute. In fact, that would be a redundant exercise because the Texas legislature is authorizing the statute to be sued upon in Texas state courts. They're opening the door to sue for violations of the TCPA, the federal act, and there's no requirement, either expressly or implicitly, to plead through the statute. Regarding the elements of the TCPA claim, there was debate in the briefs over whether prior express consent is an affirmative defense. I think the court need not reach that issue because even if it were an element of the claim and not an affirmative defense, we have uncontroverted testimony of the Browns stating that they never provided prior express consent. Importantly, there was no phone number transferred with the originating loan documents. The loan documents didn't have the cell phone number that was used on them. And Mrs. Brown testified in particular that she asked that ERS stop calling. And we know that prior express consent can be orally revoked. The Western District of Texas just decided a case in Adamczyk versus Credit Control in which Judge Sparks sets forth a detailed and thorough analysis of why the FDCPA, which is the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and the TCPA don't conflict, and that because oral consent can be granted orally under the TCPA, it can be revoked orally because common law controls. And under common law, you can revoke prior express consent with a clear expression that need not be in writing or oral. It just has to be some indication that you are withdrawing your permission for somebody to do something that would otherwise violate your rights or violate the law. Now, interestingly, when Judge Sparks decided the case, he was presuming that oral consent could be given under the TCPA. That had not been decided. In February of 2012, the TCPA revised their consent rules and held for telemarketing calls, not auto dial calls, that they were going to require now prior express written consent, while specifically preserving the possibility that prior express consent could be given orally under the provisions relating to the auto dialers, the automatic telephone dialing systems. So Judge Sparks was in fact proven more correct in the fact that after the decision, for the first time, the FCC actually acknowledged that you can give prior express consent orally under the TCPA. And you have to go back to 1992 to find the root of the prior express consent exemption to auto-dialed calls. In 1992, the FCC determined that in the context of the creditor-debtor relationship, if you provide your phone number on an application or as part of a credit application, that's fair game, and that constitutes, quote, prior express consent. Of course, it seems strange because it's implicit express consent, but nonetheless, that has been the rule. But the FCC has been perfectly clear throughout since 1992 and has affirmed on several occasions that regardless of whether it has anything to do with a debt collector or creditor, et cetera, that the Telephone Consumer Protection Act prohibits all calls placed to cellular telephones in non-emergency purposes without the prior express consent of the call party. So one of the ways a debt collector can say we have prior express consent is by pointing to a credit application saying, here's the cell phone number, that's prior express consent. In this case, we don't have that. In this case, the argument was based that because they had the number, it surely must have gotten, must have been found in connection with the transaction. Of course, if a third party will search for the number, or if the creditor will gain the number through a third source of information, that won't constitute prior express consent. So it has to be proven that that number was obtained in connection with the underlying transaction. We don't have that, and then to boot, we have Mr. and Mrs. Brown both testifying that neither gave the number. Mr. Brown testifying in the application supporting it that he didn't give the number in connection with the application. Of course, it's not there. And then, of course, Mrs. Brown testifying that she withdrew any consent which may have existed. So consent may be verbally revoked if it is an affirmative defense. If it is an element of the claim, it may be verbally revoked. I don't think there's any question that the testimony at least establishes a question. She said she revoked consent. Because it can be verbally revoked, I think that satisfies the sufficiency standard in terms of evidence. To close, there was a lot of discussion about the FCC and whether or not the FCC's interpretation should be followed. And I will cite the court to Manufacturers Auto Leasing Incorporated versus Autoflex Leasing Incorporated, which is 139 Southwest 3rd, 342. Pin site is 347. Citing another case from this court, holding that under a clear mandate from the United States Supreme Court, the court must give controlling weight to an agency interpretation of a federal statute that it administers. In this case, the appellee is attempting to take advantage of some favorable FCC rulings, the prior express consent exemption from 1992, but at the same time trying to deny that prior express consent is, as the FCC has determined, an affirmative defense upon which the creditor bears the burden. Of course, the reason that they stated was that the creditor has better access to the information and the evidence to prove it, the applications and the transactional history, which isn't always kept and by a consumer and which certainly is expected to be in the business records of a defendant. In this case, any evidence of prior express consent is conspicuously absent. And if the court views prior express consent as an affirmative defense, it need go no further. If it decides not to reach the issue of prior express consent, certainly I think there's enough evidence of withdrawal.
Any questions?
Yes, I have one. What is your response to the argument that the TCPA does not apply to debt collection calls, but only to telemarketing?
My response is that the FCC has determined on numerous occasions that the TCPA regulates automatically dialed calls to cell phones, regardless of content. And there's been several orders and regulations that are cited in our briefing from 1992 forward. The FCC has always been careful to state, even though we're saying that prior express can be granted this way, nonetheless, it still applies to debt collection calls. And they proposed rulemaking, they solicited comments, the FCC did, of course, and the debt collectors lobbied hard for an exemption for all debt collection calls. But the purpose of the statute is not based on whether it's a debt collection call or not a debt collection call. It's the basis that you can have an automatic telephone dialing system, a machine that spins around and dials the number 1,000 times with nobody needing to push those buttons. And it's extremely annoying, and it's been regarded as a nuisance by the FCC, and Congress especially created a provision that deals with automatic telephone dialing systems separate from telemarketing. And the Adams Circuit opinion is very clear on this point and is supported by the legislative history and also the FCC rulings. But it's important to separate the two because the rulings and opinions of courts who have determined that written withdrawal or written revocation is required have relied on the mistaken impression that in a case where you assert both FDCPA claims and Telephone Consumer Protection Act claims, that the FDCPA preempts somehow the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, a federal statute of equal dignity, which of course it does not. And there's a perceived conflict which doesn't really exist between the two, in that under the FDCPA, if you want communications to cease, you must notify the debt collector in writing. However, if you want calls to cease being placed to your cell phone using an automatic telephone dialing system, under the TCPA, you can merely revoke any consent that was given verbally. And again, that does not stop a debt collector from contacting you under the FDCPA. They can still call you as many times as they want, but they have to do it manually, which is inefficient. So the TCPA is very narrow in what it seeks to prohibit. The FDCPA deals with all debt collection communications ceasing. In other words, under the FDCPA, you cannot place automatic calls to people's cell phones without their prior express consent, regardless. The TCPA independently prohibits that conduct, and the FDCPA, because that may also be involved, doesn't preempt or supplant or push aside the separate requirements and prohibitions of the TCPA. If that were the case, it would create an enormous loophole, and debt collectors could begin essentially soliciting for other things while they were collecting debts and just bombard everybody's cell phones with as many calls as they wanted to, and they could claim the TCPA doesn't apply because, you know, we're dealing with the FDCPA and they had a request in writing. So I really would like to stress if there's going to be, if there's a place to start, I think the Adamczyk opinion is a very good place to start, respectfully, because it goes back and traces the history of the statute and the evolution of it and the majority of the FCC rulings. The only one that's not addressed is the one in 2012, February of 2012, which actually confirms that prior express consent may be granted orally under the sections dealing with automatic telephone dialing systems. So there's a good analysis there, and our position is precisely aligned with Judge Sparks.
Thank you.
I'd actually like to start with Justice Gardner's question. We provided today a case that came out on May the 29th, 12th, of it's called Gager, G-A-G-E-R, versus Dell Financial Services. I gave copies to the clerk, one each for the court. And if the court would turn to page 12, the final paragraph of it, it addresses your question directly. In fact, the FCC has determined that all debt collection circumstances are excluded from the TCPA coverage. And not only did the FCC say that, as well as the Gager case, there are two other 2012 cases cited in this court's opinion that specifically state the same thing, that these are two completely different animals and they shouldn't be mixed together. There are conflicting cases out there. With all due candor to the courts, they've been struggling with how to deal with this issue. The TCPA was designed for telemarketers. If the court goes back and reads the legislative history, it talks about that in great detail. This is different. This is.
Doesn't this only deal with telephone solicitation, and it doesn't deal with what counsel was speaking of regarding the, I can't remember the exact terminology used, but the automatic dialing system?
The automatic dialing system is the first step in the TCPA, and I think he was kind of jumping the two together. In this case, one of the what happened in this particular case was the court was saying this is a TCPA case and not a debt collection case, and they're saying it doesn't apply, and they were looking to distinguish this situation from Adamczyk and from Cunningham and from other cases that dealt with the fact that there was both the FDCPA and the TCPA intertwining. You are correct, Justice Walker, that this case does try to distinguish those. I was just pointing out that it quotes the FCC ruling directly, which I thought was Judge Gardner's initial question, was where it stands on and what the argument was. In due respect.
My question is, this just says that the FCC has determined that debt collection circumstances are excluded. It doesn't say that the debt under the debt collection practices act, you can nonetheless use automated dialing systems.
Okay. You're correct. This case does not address how the FDCPA applies in that situation at all. And the FDCPA does not speak to whether or not you can use automated telephone dialing systems. So you are correct, Your Honor. That's exactly what the situation is. The second issue I wanted to address.
I wanted to ask you if you decided to withdraw your first issue in light of the, or your first responsive issue about whether the Browns mooted their appeal in light of the letter that's been provided to them.
I was actually going to get to that. In the situation in the MEGA case, that was the Supreme Court case, the court specifically talked about tender of payment coupled with express intent to appeal. And in this case, timeline does matter. If the court goes back and looks at the original presentation to us and the request for satisfaction, that was done on August the 17th, I believe is the exact date. And so on August the 17th, we received a letter which is attached to our response as the appeal, stating only, we want a satisfaction of judgment, here's your payment. No reference to appeal, no discussion of it whatsoever. And frankly, I sent over the requested document. I called it a release of judgment. Under these circumstances, I don't think there's a difference between satisfaction and release to counsel as standard to ask them for their review. And then on August 29th, almost two full weeks later, I get a letter back from him saying, oh, by the way, we intend to appeal. And the difference between our situation here and the MEGA case and the Highland Park case and all the other cases that are cited in our brief is that the attempts to expressly reserve the right for appeal occurred at the time of tender in the other cases. In this case, you have a situation where for 2 weeks, we think the case is done. And then we are told by email that, oh, I intend to appeal. And if it's the case that you can just later say, I filed a motion for a new trial, which shows I intended to appeal, Judge, then we would never have a situation where the voluntary payment rule would apply, because that's all anyone would have to do to undo their waiver if, in fact, it occurred. So to me, the 2 weeks' time is the difference. He cites no case that gives you the that allows the party who is trying to defeat that argument to have the tender and the reservation of the right of appeal at two different times, two distinctly different times. Yes, ma'am, we attached it. I believe it was Appendix A.
We attached a copy of it. It's also in the court's record, Your Honor.
And attached to the satisfaction of judgment, we attached, when I filed it with the court, I attached a copy of their letter and their money orders that they provided as an exhibit to the satisfaction of judgment, so it was filed with the court of record at the time. It is in the court's record. Okay, so, and that occurred on the 17th. As the court can see from his letter, he just says, file a satisfaction of judgment. Here's your money. And then later, we get this, oh, but we intended to appeal. And so, no, ma'am, I'm not willing to withdraw that argument because I do think there is a distinction there.
Okay, but the satisfaction judgment was not filed until September 2nd?
It was filed on the 6th, Judge. I think he told me on the 29th. I don't remember if there was a holiday in there or what, but it did take me a few days to file it. So I think it was on September 6th, within a week of receiving his letter, which I think came late on the 29th. I'm not sure I actually even saw it until the next day. Okay, and I wanted to talk a little bit about a key issue that is being glossed over, and that is the first step before you get to whether or not you have a TCPA claim, and that's, do you have an automatic telephone dialing system? And that's where his claim falls apart, because there's no evidence of that. In the course of the trial, he attempted to offer into evidence a Guaranteed Contacts manual. Guaranteed Contacts was a vendor that my client used to provide them with software to operate various things, not unlike we get a Microsoft manual when we get a new computer. There was a manual that was attached. As part of discovery, we produced it. At trial, he tried to offer it into evidence, and Judge Holman upheld our objection on hearsay grounds because that's not our business record. It never was our business record. The fact that it was produced in discovery, as the court well knows, does not make it admissible at trial. There has to be some steps in there. So the only evidence before the court is the testimony of Mr. Kaufman, which is that this dialing system did not have the capacity to store, randomly generate telephone calls, which is the statutory definition of what an automated telephone dialing system is under the TCPA, is also the definition provided in the only case really on this, which is the Satterfield case out of the Ninth Court of Appeals in California. And those cases talk about specifically is the burden of the plaintiff to be able to show that the equipment is one that meets this definition. And this is a situation where technology is changing and Congress only sought to go after this one animal. And this system that they have is not that animal. There's no random generation of telephone calls. This system doesn't sit and think up 10 numbers and then call them randomly like a telemarketer system would. In fact, this one is given a specific numbered call and is told to call it. There is no evidence that this dialing system ever met that definition. He argues in his brief that it's a predictive dialer. Telling, that is a word that first appeared in argument of counsel at directive verdict. In fact, what Mr. Kaufman describes is not a predictive dialer. A predictive dialer is one where the computer just estimates when a customer service person would be available, and then it sends a call to them. Mr. Coffin testified their system would only allow calls to come through if people were available. It's the exact opposite. It sits there and waits until there's someone available and then makes calls and sends them through, which is, there are two different types of equipment that could be there. This is not a predictive dialer. There was no evidence on that. And despite the fact that the FCC says that some predictive dialers meet the definition, the truth is not all predictive dialers meet that definition. So that's an important issue here.
And Mr. Coffin said that it did not meet the definition of a predictive dialer.
I'm sorry, you say Judge Holman?
No, Mr. Coffman.
Mr. Coffman said that. Yes, ma'am. He said specifically, he gave a very detailed description of what it does and doesn't do, and when you read it all, it does not meet the definition of a predictive dialer or of an automated telephone dialing system. So either way, it doesn't go. On prior express consent, the other reason I gave the court this Gager case is that this case says you can never revoke it, that it's not provided for within the TCPA statute. It looks at the Adamachek case. It looks at Cunningham, which is the Northern District case, which says revocation must be in writing. It looks at a number of cases that say that. The courts are all over the board on this. There's no consistent ruling. The Fifth Circuit has given us no guidance. There's no ruling from any state court about whether or not you can even revoke it, and if you can, in what manner you can revoke it. I would point the court to, we provided as secondary authority only, Judge Hoyt's analysis from a hearing in Southern District so that the court would see how the Southern District was doing it. The Northern District says revocation must be in writing. Judge Hoyt says in great detail and gives some very good logic about why that the revocation must be in writing. The only opinion that says it can be oral is Adamachek, which is a district court opinion from Judge Sparks out of Austin. So at least two out of the four districts for Texas have held the revocation must be in writing if you're doing it. But in this case, it's very interesting who the oral revocation was made by, because the allegation that the oral revocation was made was by Carrie Brown. And as the court will remember, Carrie Brown was the wife. She's not the person who provided consent. She's also not the person they were trying to call. The person they were trying to reach, the only person who was involved in the actual business relationship of the loan, was Christopher Brown. He never spoke to anyone, so he didn't revoke in writing or orally the right to do that. I bring that up also because of the Lysy case, and I may be butchering that with my West Texas accent. It's L-E-Y-S-E. In that case, the court refused to grant a roommate the right to have a suit under a TCPA under similar facts. The court said, you can intercept a phone call. That doesn't make it a TCPA claim. And in this case, Carrie Brown was not the person who was being reached or attempted to be reached. The only person was Christopher Brown, who would have the standing and the right to revoke if there was one. And the point in the Lysy case, they talked about, if there's a fax coming into judges' chambers, which could be a violation of the TCPA, if a law clerk comes by and sees the fax, they receive the bad fax, that's not a violation of the TCPA for that law clerk because they don't have standing. They're not the party that was being reached or attempted to be reached.
But she handled, according to the testimony, Mr. Brown's bills and business dealings through using that telephone? Which
no, ma'am.
Both of them?
She didn't. According to her testimony, two things. He had a first wife. So the first Mrs. Brown was the one who, according to his testimony, may have provided the phone number and signed up the agreement. His testimony was he doesn't know if she gave the cell phone number or not. The first wife was involved when the original note was done. Now, Mrs. Brown did testify that she signed up for, after my client contacted her, that she provided a cell phone number and contact information when the lien was ultimately placed on the on their taxes, and she did they call them a rehabilitation program. She testified that at that time she did it. Our point of that testimony with her was that she, in fact, knew that they had an obligation to provide accurate telephone numbers to the federal mm-hmm. government, and this was a federal student loan, and that obviously that phone number came from them. So I wanted to finish with talking about a quote from the Texas Supreme Court. It's the City of Keller versus Wilson case cited by plaintiff. Only an incompetent or willful judge would take a case from the jury when the issue should be left to the jury. Judges of competence and conscience have in the past and will in the future disagree whether proof in a case is sufficient to demand submission to the jury. The fact that one thinks there was enough to leave the case to the jury doesn't indicate that the other is unmindful of the jury's function. The easy but timid way out for a trial judge is to leave all cases tried to a jury for jury determination. But in doing so, he fails in his duty to take a case from the jury when the evidence would not warrant a verdict by it. A timid judge, like a biased judge, is intrinsically a lawless judge. In his opening brief, plaintiff's counsel describes Justice Holman as being a retired visiting judge who was unfamiliar with the case. At the time of directed verdict, Justice Holman had heard all of the evidence that was admitted in the case, and he was vastly more familiar than any trial court would be at the time of summary judgment. His experience and sterling reputation as a justice on this court and trial court speaks volumes about his understanding of the standards of review and of judicial conduct. Incompetent judge, willful judge, timid judge, biased judge, lawless judge, Dixis Holman is none of those things. Thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
You indicated that you believe that the case fell apart because of the fact that this was used by your client to not qualify as an automatic telephone dialing system?
Yes, ma'am.
But in the definition of the statute, it says that means equipment which has the capacity to store or produce telephone numbers to be called.
Yes, ma'am. And Mr. Kaufman testified that that system does not store.
Every time they place a call, they manually re-enter the...
Every day. Every day they have to put in the numbers to be called that day.
So he called those numbers that day without inputting them.
He didn't testify to that, and I don't know the answer to that. That was not in the record. What he said was that we are required, he says a human has to make the decision for those calls. Wait a minute, I do remember what he said, Justice Walker. He said that they did it twice a day, and that he and his client, he and his team met in the morning, and they made calls, and then after lunch they looked at calls for whatever reason they chose to either run again or to make a second decision on. So they did it twice a day, but he said that every call was decided by their group of folks. He sent those calls to their system, and all it did was just call them as it worked through the list that he provided.
Automatic.
It was automatic in a sense that it goes to a computer and a computer decides it, but the computer doesn't create the phone number and it doesn't store them. They don't store them for reasons that are actually fairly logical, because it with the volume of calls they have to make, it would take up too much room to store them. So as a practical matter, it's never going to store numbers more than a day, because I don't remember what their numbers are, but a lot of these folks make up to, you know, they can make thousands of calls a month, and if you can just imagine the database that would take on your system, you wouldn't want it to store. But they don't store them, and his testimony was that they made a decision every day, twice a day. I believe that was exactly what he said in his testimony. If you'd like, I'd be happy to find a site for you. Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to stress in rebuttal that nobody is attacking Judge Holman or his competence or his ability. I'd just like to stress that I have a great deal of respect for Judge Holman. I'm familiar with his work and his life. But this is not about attacking him. This is about evidence being presented at trial. So I want to make that clear, first of all. Mr. Kaufman's testimony is set forth, it's in the record, and it's discussed in our brief. The testimony is fairly clear, actually. The reason that companies use automatic telephone dialing systems or predictive dialers is to prevent their employees from having to continuously punch numbers. So if you have five employees, and those five employees have to manually dial each number, they can call a certain number of numbers each day. If you have five employees and an automatic dialer or a predictive dialer, in which you put in a tray of numbers, and that dialer will dial those numbers repeatedly, whether it's twice or five or seven times, or has the capacity to do so. And when it detects a live voice or a real person, transfer that call to an agent who is standing by, you increase efficiency by a remarkable amount. And that's why these automatic telephone dialing systems or predictive dialers pose such a threat to privacy and are such a nuisance because it doesn't cost the company money, time, or effort to spin it around and just shoot out thousands and thousands of calls. But everybody who receives these calls is having to look at their cell phone and turn it off or put it in their purse or be charged for it, and it's an extreme nuisance. So the FCC has focused on the effect and the purpose of the technology, and even if we're looking at a strict technical definition, Mr. Kaufman's testimony satisfies the standard for predictive dialer. It's clear that he tried not to testify in a manner that would give rise to conclusive proof that the technology qualifies as a predictive dialer, but his testimony set forth establishes what the system does and how it's used. And the notion that he testified that every time they call that number, somebody is making an independent decision and punching those buttons is just not in line with his actual testimony, and it's not in line with the other evidence. So I think even aside from the GC contacts manual that was excluded, which expressly states this is a predictive dialer, by the way, even if you discount that completely and don't look at that, his testimony alone is enough to establish the predictive dialer aspect. Prior express consent is an affirmative defense. I just wanted to quote the FCC's declaratory ruling from 2008, which states, and this is ruling 07-232, and the site is 23 FCCR 559, pin site is 565. This is also in our briefing. To ensure that creditors and debt collectors call only those consumers who have consented to receive auto-dialed and pre-recorded message calls, we conclude that the creditor should be responsible for demonstrating that the consumer provided prior express consent. The creditors are in the best position to have records kept in the usual course of business showing such consent, such as purchase agreements, sales slips, and credit applications. Should a question arise as to whether express consent was provided, the burden will be on the creditor to show it obtained the necessary prior express consent. That opinion, whether or not absolutely binding on this court, I think is entitled and should be treated with some level of deference. It's consistent with past rulings. It's consistent with other federal statutes interpreting prior express consent. It's certainly consistent with the February 2012 ruling, and
could you address their argument that the fact that the money was tendered and the cover letter says please file a notice of satisfaction of judgment, and that's dated August 17th, and your letter giving them the notice of your intent to appeal didn't come in until after that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you address that argument there, please?
I think that the exclusion of our letter is telling in that I don't think there was any mistake or question about our consent. We requested a satisfaction of judgment for the purposes of halting the accrual post-judgment interest, and there was never any question until we received what the appellee proposed to file, which is a release of judgment, and I saw that and instantly replied that this is not the intent and resolved any question that may or may not have existed. I think it's important that the satisfaction of judgment, which we purportedly requested to be filed, wasn't filed until after our letter was received, making it clear that we would appeal. So I don't think that there was ever any question about whether we were going to appeal this case. I think it was abundantly clear the whole time. And only when I received a release of judgment did I want to make even more clear that we would appeal. So I think it's telling that was omitted from the record, the response letter. And if you read the briefing, you'll find, I believe, that the mootness argument is based on the satisfaction of judgment which was filed, and the argument is made that we requested a satisfaction of judgment to be filed to completely resolve this matter. That's the argument that's made. That is not what happened in this case. And that's it's certainly the only way that I know how to address that. I understand, I appreciate the concern for the timing, but again, the satisfaction of judgment is what's relied on in making the argument that the appeal is moot, and the argument again is made that that satisfaction of judgment was filed absent any reservation or indication on the part of the Browns to appeal. I think, obviously, well before that was filed, the satisfaction of judgment, certainly, because we'd requested that they send it to us, and when they sent it to us, we looked at it and said, yeah, certainly not. So then they filed something different and did not file a release and did not include our letter. So it was a continuing process. We paid and asked for something that would have been filed, and when the wrong thing came back, we objected and made our intentions even more clear. Again, I think the intent has been clear throughout that we would appeal. I think that's shown by the fact that the letter was omitted. From
was there anything that you did before August 17th letter to indicate that you intended to pursue an appeal, a motion for new trial, contest the judgment ruling?
We filed a motion for a new trial.
That wasn't until September. Anything before the August 17th letter?
I'm sure that there were probably communications. I think I was upset after the trial. I think it was, I don't know, I can't remember whether we discussed appealing. I don't want to say that we did without knowing. I certainly would be able to go back and find any communications between us. I know I certainly talked to my clients immediately after trial and notified them that we would be appealing. So if a communication is required, I can certainly search for the most recent and submit that along with an affidavit. I'm not certain whether before the satisfaction of judgment we requested came to us to approve, whether there was a direct communication. I just don't want to tell the court that there was a bill.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Your case is submitted. We do appreciate your argument. Both of you came from a distance. Your argument's been helpful and done. It's a thorny issue. I'm sure both sides recognize it. So, we do have a question.
All right. On the cover of your brief is the name the Lex Group, and I was curious to know if that's another law firm or a printing company.
No, we're the only firm handling this matter, so it would be a printing company. I hadn't seen that, but it was all our firm.
Okay, that's all the questions. Then you are excused. Go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.
Thank you.
All rise.